Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Tammy Gilbert with us, the author of Courage to Perceive, A Compelling Story of Struggle, Survival, and Triumph. Tammy should probably have ended up as a statistic, someone bitter, broken, and rootless. She beat the odds, and it was no accident. Born and raised in Nigeria, she was abandoned by her father when she was only 8 years old, and then by her mother. And after being taken in by relatives, she left Africa when she was 15 years old, expecting to live with her father. Instead, she found something that wasn't the best in the world for her. She found herself unwanted and living in a cousin's dark and cold basement in Chicago, resolving to triumph over the mean circumstances life had handed her. And her new memoir, Courage to Perceive, A Compelling Story of Struggle, Survival, and Triumph, it's due out next month, and we'll find out about it. But today, we have her right here. Tammy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. My goodness, there's so many people who would have gone through the same thing who would not have made it. What was that something inside of you? What was that inner strength that caused you, allowed you to be able to maneuver, get through this, and become who you are today?
Well, when I arrived in Chicago, I was excited to come to Chicago and to live with my father. And when we got here, myself, my sister, and my brother, when we got here, he didn't have a place for us to live. So he took us to my cousins. And when we got there, it was very clear that he didn't want us there. And so we had to live in a basement, my sister and I. And,
yeah.
It was cold, dark. And one night, so what got me, what gave me the drive is that one night as I lay in that tiny bed, shivering and cold and unable to sleep, I made a promise to myself. I will do whatever it takes to get out of this basement.
So and by the way, what was that first step to get out?
What was
your first step? How did you get out of that basement?
Well, the first step that when I made that promise, I realized education was my way out of the that basement. So after finishing high school, even though I was bullied, but I didn't focus on that. I was focusing on I have to get out of this basement. And in order to do that, I need education so I can get a job and I'll be able to afford a warm place to live. And so I got to college. And once I got to college, of course, I keep running into this obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. And when I got in college, I didn't have money to pay the tuition. And my father couldn't help me. And I wasn't a citizen of the United States at the time, so I didn't qualify for financial aid. So I had to work like 2-3 jobs to pay for my college tuition. And after a lot of work, I was able to get my Bachelor of Science in Nursing. So that's how I first got out of the basement.
Now, by the way, your nursing career, you coped with a lot of institutional racism. What happened when we talk about that? Institutional. It's more than just the culture. It's institutional. It's like within the school, within the studies, within the circumstances, there was racism.
Yeah. Well, my first experience of a real racism was in the institution where I worked. After I finished my Bachelor of Science in Nursing, I also went back to get 2 master's degrees after that. And, after I struggled to get all this education. I said, oh, you know, I finally arrived and in my dreamland. And then I got a job with one of the biggest teaching institute hospital in Chicago. And that's when I first experienced racism in corporate America. And I found myself not being able to move up the corporate ladder. All the positions that I was able to get didn't require an advanced degree. And, you know, all I can say is that racism is big and real, but not too many people wants to talk about it or wants to go to back with you on it. So what I can do, I promise myself again that I will find a job that I can live up to my potential.
Now, but by the way, how did you experience, let me stop you just for a second because I think this is important. How did you experience the racism? You know, an example of what occurred when you knew specifically that's what it was.
Well, I would apply for a different position, and it would be given to the people, the people of a different color that didn't have the same degree that I have. And I know I qualify for it. And I would see different people of the race in different positions that I couldn't get. And so that's when I, and then when we voice or when we want, when we have something to contribute, we felt that they were not listening. You know, the manager or management were not listening. That's when I experienced racism in corporate America.
Now, how long ago was that?
Believe it or not, that's within the last 10 years.
Okay, yes. Do you feel that there's any change now?
No, not at all. Unfortunately,
okay.
No.
All right, so it's still there, and it's still one of those things that hold a lot of people back. But how did you get beyond that? How did you move beyond what happened corporately?
Well, I continued, so I look and see, what can I do? What can I do to in this situation? And what I did is I started looking for a different job. I would, every day I would do something to find another job. And eventually, a friend was able to get me an interview and with a lot of research and a lot of preparation on my part, I was able to get a position as a clinical, like a nurse clinical coordinator, which I'm very proud of it. I'm happy now. I'm in a different place now. I'm happy,
sure.
And I feel like I'm acting, I'm using my skill in this position.
Now, by
so
the
that's
way,
how,
well, you know,
yeah.
Go ahead.
That's how I was able to move past that.
Now, by the way, in moving past that, what lessons did you learn out of that personally? How did that make you stronger?
Well, I was almost broken at the time. My self-esteem was really low.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned out of that is to always believe in myself. Believe in what I can do and not let anybody tell me what I can't or cannot do because I know what I can do. And the management, sometimes they even have a lesser degree than, you know, I did. And, you know, sometimes they say, well, what they tell you, it may be more about them than about me. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, so I learned just, you know, to believe in myself and believe in my skill and believe in what I can do.
You know, being bullied, you know, both as a child and as an adult, it gives you a certain strength, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, I was bullied in high school, you know, when I first came here from Nigeria. Of course, I didn't know how to dress properly or I was, you know, wearing Afro. But I focused. I wanted the education. Education was my way out of that basement. So I focused on that instead of focusing on the bully. And then as an adult in the workplace, being bullied by people that have power and people who, I mean, it's more, almost more like an abusive, just
sure.
because they have a power and because we need a job. You know, we all have a bill to pay, and we have a we need that job, so, and they know that. So,
what about the kids coming up today? If you could sit down with some of them, what would you point out? You know, if you can anticipate a problem before it happens, it helps you move through much faster. What would you say to kids today in similar situations?
Well, I would tell those kids that it's more about the kids that's doing the bullying than them, and that they need to focus on why are they at school. They're there to get education, and why, so they can move on in the world, so they can get a better job, get a better life. And I will advise them to focus on the purpose of being in school. Yeah, because it's not really about them. That's what.
No,
and
what
really
I'm hearing you say basically is this: it doesn't have to do with race, it doesn't have to do with gender, it has to do with the people that you're dealing with, their own
exactly.
weaknesses, and they're projecting them out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, but this is a good lesson, but for anybody, anywhere, and it doesn't matter what the condition or the situation is when you really come down to it. You know,
exactly.
One of the rules that you live by is anything is possible if you believe. That's really the key, isn't it? You've got to believe, A, in yourself and believe that you can do it, and then it'll
exactly.
happen. If you don't have that belief, it's nothing's going to happen for you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you have to have a faith. You know, I don't know. I'm kind of spiritual, so I have faith
mm-hmm.
that it can happen. And then I have the formula for success that I use, which is desire plus vision plus taking action and perseverance. And that's where my book came from, Courage to Persevere. And
yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, having faith and taking action. And then remember, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why do I want an education? That's what I kept in front of my mind. Why is it so important to get education? So I can afford to buy a house and live in a warm house. And then I also had a vision to have a warm home and a loving family. So
mm-hmm.
to be able to get a family and so on and so on.
Really, when you come down to do you have children?
Yes, I do. Now I have 3 children.
Ah, wonderful.
Yes,
see,
yes.
Because when it comes down to it, everything that happened to you, you reverse it. And everything that happened to you, you reverse it. And those kids, they completely and totally benefit from it.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, I shared the story and I shared the lesson learned as well. And in the book, I also did the same thing. You know, I share my experience, and then I also share the lessons learned. And then at the end of every chapter, I provide exercise that the reader could do and apply it to themselves. There's a different exercise, one that could help them move past their past, because past is past. What happened, you can't use what happened in the past as an excuse for now. And
yeah.
it doesn't matter why it happened or how it happened. What happened is what matters is about now and what can you do to improve the future. And
sure.
So there's a different exercise to
and realistically, things are going to happen. There's no question. You
exactly.
can't stop somebody from walking up and slapping you in the face, but you can control how you experience it and what you do and what actions you take about it. And I think that's really what life is about. You can't control what comes at you, but you can control how you respond
how
to it, and that's the key.
Exactly, exactly. Because I could respond differently to bullying, or even when I was experiencing the racism in the workplace, but how I responded, because I know what my focuses are, and I just
yeah.
focus on what's important.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And, you know, we live in a world where, you know, we face all of these things every day. Sometimes It's not because somebody feels that way. It's because somebody tells them to feel that way, and it goes on and on. There's so much division going on right now. But the key is if you live a whole life within yourself, those things,
exactly.
No matter what happens, you move through.
Yeah, you know, we are in control. We are in control of our own life. And when things happen, when things are not going our way, it's like, what can we do? Because we don't have a control over other people. I didn't have a control over my manager. I didn't have a control over the student that bullied me in high school. But I have a control over what I can do, and that is to work hard toward my goal and to achieve my dream that I had.
You know, one of the things I've learned over the years is that toughness in and of itself, it's not how physically tough you are, it's how emotionally tough you are that will bring you through this world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It does, and sometimes people also need to realize they may need help of a professional to, you know, to get stronger.
Sure.
To deal with what's going on and to move past it. And it's just an individual thing. You know, some people are able to look inside themselves and be able to deal with it, and some people need professional help.
Sure, and more than anything else, what we are dealing with is guidance. You know, because we were born on this planet does not mean we know how to handle every situation there is. That's a life learning experience. Those are lessons that we come up across, and there are people who need help. Could be psychological help. It could be any kind of different help. But at least there's someone out there to point them in the right direction. You know,
exactly.
Living life, it's not by accident. Living life is a skill.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's a skill, and it's consistently being in action. Because I mean, we're not going to succeed every time, every attempt. So
no.
It's not, you know, that saying that it's not about how we fell, but it's how we got up and move forward. And that's what we have to keep in mind, that any goals that we set for ourselves, any dream we set for ourselves, is achievable if we just be in action and be focused. You know,
But I think that's the key there. It's being focused, knowing what you're going to do, when you're going to do it, and where you're going to do it. And that comes from life experiences. Any way you look at it, it's the experience of life.
Exactly.
And if you go back to all the people who bullied you and all of the things that happened to you as, you know, as a younger woman and as a child, as you are today, you can go back and say thank you. You would not be here doing what you're doing today if those things hadn't happened to you.
Absolutely. They have made me stronger. They have made me very strong. And, you know, with my father, too, whatever happened that, you know, he left and I couldn't live with him, now I can thank him. I can look back and thank. There was a time I was angry, but I learned to forgive and let go. And now he did me a favor, because if he had handed me everything, maybe I wouldn't be where I am today. You know, with two master and nice job and nice house and so and so on.
Yeah, and when you really come down to it, he didn't know what he was doing, but he did the best he could with what he had in the world and how he was taught to live.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, and that's it. We do with what we have. And if you don't have it, you can't do anything with it. And it takes, let's say, for instance, you know, your book. If I can sit down, hypothetically, if I could sit down and read your book in 2 or 3 hours and have it all done, I get in 2 or 3 hours what it took you a lifetime to create.
Yes. And that was the purpose. That was the reason I wrote the book, in the effort to help other people.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Now, Tammy, we're running out of time now, so let me ask you this.
Okay.
The website we can find you at and find the book. What is your website?
My website is www.tammygilbert.com, and that's with TammyGilbert.com. And they can buy the book there, or they can buy it at Amazon.com. It will be available next month. And also, the listener can go to the website and be able to download The 8 Secrets of Achieving Your Goals Fast. And also, they can also sign up for a free consultation where they will get help to crystallize their goals and help with developing action steps to take with timelines to reach that goal, and also to help them put proper structure in place to evaluate their progress and modify as necessary. And also at the website, they can also sign for free webinar and learn strategies to achieve your goals.
Wonderful. Again, the website,
TammyGilbert.com.
Okay, and by the way, if anybody missed it, it's up on our website right now so they can come back and find it. Tammy Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. Hello. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. And we've got the engineers working their work off, and they're doing a job today. Betty Withrow with us, and she is the author of Prevail, 7 Days to Promote a Personal Victory. Betty is the owner of the Big Sur Retreat Camp and Creative Victory Life Coaching, and she's a certified life coach. National Association of Professional Women honors Betty as a 2015-2016 inductee into its VIP Women of the Year. She's recognized with this prestigious distinction for leadership and coaching. And let us say great, because we have her with us right now. Betty, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the title of the book in and of itself says a whole lot. It's called Prevail. And when many people don't move forward or frightened to death of the next move, the next step, they don't prevail. So the key is to be able to live your life and at the end of the day come out being you, not just something that everybody else created.
That's right. That is exactly how it is.
Now, what caused you to write the book? What was it about Prevail? What was it about I lost the word. I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I survival. What was it about that started you out on this?
Well, actually, I believe that life is life is more than survival. Life is actually living, and that's what Prevail is about. I came from a very difficult background early in my life, and I learned that simply surviving just kind of makes everything gray and uninteresting. And so I really believe that the message of moving on through no matter what happens and finding a way to make it useful is what this book is about.
You know, the term personal victory, I think, is so critically important. And the reason for that, Betty, is this, that we spend our lives trying to shape ourselves so everybody's going to accept us out there. So at the end of the night, most people don't have a personal victory. They have whatever victory means, but based on someone else's idea of who they should be. And I think personal victory in and of itself is the absolute key to being able to live a very satisfying and comfortable life, no matter what goes on.
Right. It's that inner authenticity of saying that I'm not living someone else's dream. I'm going to take the message of my life forward and create something that is beautiful out of no matter what it is that happened, and step into that.
You know, what went on in your life early on that caused you to do what you're doing today?
Well, early in life, I grew up in a very deeply abusive and traumatic experience in my childhood. And I went through a lot of changes with that, including going through parts of the social institutions and so on. And then I found myself in the country learning to basically make something out of nothing. And because it landed in the wilderness, and it was all about using your wits as well as possible.
Yeah.
So that...
Well, prevail
that
and survival, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that message, I feel, has validity for everyone. I mean, you know, thank goodness not everyone has had the types of experiences that I had. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book, Michael, is to find the value for myself in what my experiences have been and know that I did the best I could do in my life to turn that around and make it useful to other people.
Yeah, and by the way, when you come down to it, you in the general sense of the word, when you come down to it, the word prevail, you know, it's a skill. This is not something that comes to someone automatically. You learn your life lessons. You learn the steps to take. You learn that there is a skill in moving through step by step anything that confronts you. So where did that come for you? What are the keys to create that personal victory? How did you create them?
Well, I had an experience of becoming extremely overwhelmed one day, and my response was to say, okay, well, it's actually a good message because I have so much going on that I can't deal with it. Then how about if I just lay back and listen to what life says? And I came up with, after a while, it came to me that I had gotten where I was because of qualities within myself. That and those are the chapters of the book. The seven keys are literally the qualities that allow a person to become victorious in their life.
So as you move through life, each one of those keys was something that you personally went through and you discovered, and you were able to put them in such a way that someone else could take advantage of them.
Yes. That's what the intention of the book is to offer my experience so that other people can pick up on the general principles of it and say, oh, I see how this is the same principle that's happening in my life, and use their own abilities to find how to apply that principle in what they're doing.
Now, underneath, it's a message. There's no question about that. Well, everything that we deal with, there's something underneath that tells us something. What's the message here?
The message is that people have the answers within themselves, and in many cases they don't realize it because they're blocked by things such as what you mentioned earlier, living up to other people's ideas, or feeling possibly afraid of what would it be like if they actually became victorious. Who, you know, how would that change their lives? But the message is that the keys are right there in your hand. It's all right there. And my purpose is to help people to to get past their illusions that they can't do things.
And it is an illusion. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, 20, 25 years ago, if I met you, I would be showing you what I thought you wanted to see in me. You know, that's not the way my life works today, but that in and of itself is really what most people do. I'm afraid that you may not like what you see, so I'm going to be what you want me to be. And by the time we get comfortable together and I become me, what's the question you ask me? You say, gee, why are you changing? And it never changed. Me is coming out. And you don't like the me that there is. And I think that, in and of itself, is a major problem that we face in today's world.
Oh, I completely agree. How many personal relationships do each of us know personally that have disintegrated for exactly that reason? I mean,
oh,
you know,
sure.
Whether it's friendship or a marriage, whatever, you know. Yeah.
You got two people running around that aren't who they really are. And look at the percentage of divorces in the world that we have today. You know, you're talking 50-60% of first-year marriages don't make it that far, you know, within that first year. And one of the reasons I really feel strong about is, one is communication, because they're not hearing what the other person is saying. And the other thing is they don't sit down and get commonality of value. You know, if my values are totally different than yours, and I'm not going to tell you and you're not going to tell me, now all of a sudden, as we get comfortable with each other, they start to come out. There's the, you know, the battle start.
Right, and it's all because of a lack of authenticity, of people feeling like they can't really allow the world to know who they really are. And, you know, I got pretty bold in revealing some things about my life and my presence that are very, they make me vulnerable. And I just kind of had to say, well, vulnerability is not as important as the fact that that will free other people to say, I can be who I am too, you know. And it was a great thing too that I was able to step through that discomfort and say, you know, this is what I got and this is what I made out of it. And it's for you. That's what I want my reader to know.
Betty, when you sat down and started writing this book, did you really then start to discover yourself? Because, you know, you can have all the steps, all the stuff, but when you start to put it on paper and you step away from it and look it through another set of eyes, you start to learn things, don't you?
Yes. I really feel like a different person than I was when I started the book.
Yeah. Yeah, it allowed you to go inside and see who you really are. And sometimes it's surprising, isn't it? Shocking.
Yes. I was very uncomfortable at your point in writing the book. And then I was also blessed with an editor who asked me really hard questions, and then I'd have to say, oh, you mean I have to look at that and think of that again and answer that question that you just asked me? So, but that was great because it helped me to come to terms with things that I've been dealing with all my life and see them in a different way and move on.
It's so important,
you know,
to be able to...
I got my own, you know, that was cool.
Oh, yeah, and it's so important to be able to look at yourself and look at the world, actually, through a different set of eyes and know, you know, start to realize that there's something more there than you were aware of or you've experienced before. It's kind of like bringing the invisible up to the table, things that were always there. One of the things that we find is in a very strong transition to make, and I've talked about this, God knows how many times, but it's so important, the difference between need and want. If you need someone or something there, if there's something about them that you need, if that disappears, well, they have no basis to be there anymore. But if you want, all of a sudden it's a completely different story. I think the want is much more powerful than the need.
That's a good way of looking at it. It allows for that change, you know, for people to change. Well, I want this, you know, in talking with you or relating with you. And if you can say that, instead of I need this, then the other person could say, well, yes or no, rather than, well, I can or cannot. It's completely different.
I'll tell you how that came up for me, which is, I've told the story before, but it's just a great story. I was divorced in, I think, 2002. And I stayed at the house, and, you know, it's like anything else. It was a great divorce. She still does my taxes. It wasn't one of those horrible things, just time. So I'm at the house, and you know how it is. If you're with somebody long enough, you still hear their voices and the footsteps and the rest of it. So I'm in the kitchen. I got the dogs and cats with me. I'm by myself, and I started to make tacos one night. And I just started making them, and I started making them, and I was putting all these things together. I had the kitchen table filled. I mean, you know, 15 people could have eaten. I just loaded everything up. And I sat down and started eating, and I was enjoying the tacos. And I realized that I was really enjoying myself, and I didn't need anybody there to be able to enjoy myself. That didn't mean I didn't want somebody there, but then he took it farther. I don't need anybody to go out and have dinner with. I can go into a restaurant and enjoy myself. Again, doesn't mean I don't want somebody. But when you get away from this need stuff, it drives you to places, the need drives you to places that sometimes can reach back and bite you.
Yeah. That's right. Learning how to be with yourself and be happy about that is a great feeling when you finally get that. Actually, I don't need someone else. I don't need someone else to be there and tell me something or be something for me or any of that. I can actually just be the way I am and know that it's okay. That's a tremendous amount of freedom to have in your spirit.
The one thing I have to say is that, you know, with the tacos, they were so good, I kind of bought myself that night, so it was okay, a little inducement. But the point of contention is that that's really what life is about, is the difference between that need and want. We've been taught as a society, as a culture, that we need certain things to be happy. We need certain things to be stable. We need certain things to be satisfied. That's garbage. Throw it out the window. You need yourself. I mean, you want yourself. I mean, that's all it is when it comes down to it.
Yeah. I have had that experience firsthand. Even when you actually step into a place of not having, it's amazing what you can find that you can do without, which is almost everything, you know, except
for, absolutely.
You know, the few little things.
But is there any
like,
such thing as nothing?
Love, respect, you know.
But think about this.
You
is there
that.
Any such thing as nothing? You always have yourself. And I've always
right.
thought, I mean, for many years now, I'll take back, I always thought, for many years now I've experienced that happiness is something you can't have if you want something to make you happy. More money will make you happy, a relationship will make you happy, a new car will make you happy. Throw it out the window. The happiness is inside,
right.
And you don't need anything. What happens is when you become comfortable with yourself, you begin to allow it to step out. And know that it won't get hurt and stepped on.
I agree with that. I think that's exactly right. And it's true. There isn't really any such a thing as nothing, and there is really, truly no such thing as being alone. I mean, it's not even possible. We're always
right.
surrounded with things. So, you know, that's all right there.
Yeah, and you know, when it really comes down to it, We think about,
yes.
you know, we do things for ourselves. No, we don't. For the most part, the majority of everything we do is based on what somebody else is going to think. When you got dressed this morning, who'd you dress for? Now, you can say you dressed for yourself, but think about it. Would you go out into the street without any clothes on? Of course not. You hear it? You're dressed because of standards, because of this and what somebody's going to think of, etc. So when we get to the point of dressing for ourselves, experiencing life for ourselves. And that doesn't mean that you're selfish. It just means you're strong enough, and guess what? The person that's with you or the people that are around you get such a gift out of that.
Yeah, I think authenticity is the greatest gift that a person can give to the world. Instead of pretending to be someone that you think you're supposed to be and wanting the things that you think you're supposed to want, then go ahead and be honest with about who it is that can actually have that simple happiness that's already right there waiting by simply letting go of all of the should of life. You know, that should
yeah.
is just not an operative word. It's a prisoner
should
word.
Shoulda, coulda, woulda.
So,
and then why get all the way up to the time you're going to leave the planet, you know, when it's all over with and look back and think about all the things you could have done, should have done, would have done. And it would be very interesting if we could live our lives like this, but it's kind of hard. But if at midnight tonight you knew it was the end of your life, how different would your life be? What would you think about? What would scare you? What wouldn't scare you? What are some of the worries that you have now that would just disappear?
Yeah, that's one of the things. If you ever have faced a life-threatening illness, as I have, you know that things really do shift. It's just, you know, all kinds of things simply don't matter anymore.
No.
And, you know, it's great if you remember that. If you live through it and you manage to remember that afterward, then life becomes truly much more enjoyable in a certain way, because there's just not a bunch of phony expectations attached to your day.
And wait, you just said it, phony expectations. They're not real.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I got it. Okay. All right, we are starting to run out of time now, so let me ask you this. The website we can find you at.
Yeah, the website is www.bettyofbigsur.com.
Okay,
and
bettyofbigsur.com.
Bettyofbigsur.com. That's where I live. I've lived in Big Sur for over 40 years. And
wow.
There you'll find information about the book and some information about my coaching, retreat opportunities, because I do retreats here, and I love to talk to people. I love to get in touch with people, so if anyone wants to contact me, I'd be overjoyed to talk to them.
Yeah, which is great. Okay, by the way, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time that you've spent with us, and I love what you're doing. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity, Michael, and I've really enjoyed talking with you as well.
Wonderful. Okay, take care, and go get them.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You want to see a magic land? Close your eyes and you will see all. Want to be a dreamer? You are. Anytime you speak, be safe, be one. Come with me.
Almost there. Hold on.
Good. Happy.
Happiness is. It's a good thing. Okay. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Elizabeth Upton with us is a writer, a motivational speaker based in Santa Barbara, California. Prior to publishing her first book, she was a nun for a decade and also worked as a family counselor, a social worker, a probation officer for troubled youth. Elizabeth is a graduate of Syracuse University, earned her MA in psychology from Chapman University. Elizabeth just published her memoir, Secrets of a Nun, My Own Story, as well as novels The Shaman and the Mafia, The Exuberant Woman, Don't Age, No Time to Waste. And let us say, Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's wonderful to be on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Secrets of a Nun, my own story. Define a nun. And when I say define it, from your heart, from what you experienced, that certain something that caused you to move in that direction. What is a nun?
A nun is a woman, obviously, who wants to give her life or dedicate her life in the service of love and compassion, and to give up married life through the vow of chastity, and to live in a community of women through obedience and poverty, meaning that they don't own anything individually. And by this type of sacrifice, they feel they can give more of themselves in the service of humanity, suffering humanity, and wherever it may take them.
Okay, now, when you were a nun, did you find that?
Yes, I did. I actually did. I was a very young person. I was extraordinarily young. I had just turned 16 when I entered into the convent. And,
wow.
And I stayed in this religious life for some 20 years. But it was actually, I grew into womanhood, as a very young person. And then I involved myself in the embrace of compassion, in the embrace of service. So it was a growing process, and I really realized a lot of goodness in this life. And it carries on, even though I am no longer a nun. I still love silence. I love contemplation. I like to meditate. It just carries on.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I think that to talk about any subject, no matter what it is, there's got to be commonality of definition. So the question, what is a nun, you know, has nothing behind it. It's, what is it? And, you know, there's so many people who really don't know what it is, what that draw is. But if you had all the experience that you have now, as the woman you are now, could you have been a better nun than you were when you walked in at 16?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I feel that I gave my best through the years. I really do. I won't say be my best after I left, but definitely when I was a nun. Absolutely. No question about it.
And you didn't run through the hill singing?
I didn't what?
You did not run through the hill singing. I love
that
movie.
Oh, that is so funny. Yes, we did sing the Gregorian chants, but, you know, that metaphor, I could put it in a different way. Yes, there was many experiences of transformational experiences of happiness and of joy throughout, not all the time, but it is a structure that promotes that. To leave that life, for me, I had to build a different type of structure for quiet and meditation, but it's conducive for this type of life. And, it's a wonderful life, actually.
But I'm sure it is. But what about loving? Do you have a family now?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Let me tell you something. And this is a strange thing to say, but I may say it quite honestly.
Sure.
It has been far more challenging when I left, going into a family, having family.
Yeah.
That has become far more challenging, would you believe it, than living the life of a nun. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. It's got to be. You've got the challenge of other mindsets, of other thoughts, of other expectations. Sure.
Absolutely. And in some ways, many ways, you are sheltered from the world. We were sheltered from the world. Even though I worked in very desperate situations, I would come home to a life of holiness, serenity, and prayer.
Yeah.
So I had that wonderful structure. So to leave it, to have a family, to live in the world, let me tell you, more than challenging.
You're done with the day, and they're sitting down saying, where's dinner? Sure. That was a little different than today.
And that's the easy part.
It's true. You know, when you really come down to it, the challenges that, you know, we have, you know, with families and people, et cetera. You're right. When you were a nun, that everything was very specific, what you did and how you did it and so on and so forth, and, you know, your quiet and easy time. This way, there's more things expected of you, and you have to deal with a lot of different mindsets of the people that you're with. You love them, they're your family, but they don't think the way you think.
Absolutely. And there's always different challenges. Not that there isn't when you are a nun. There are challenges. And often it is in the environment that you work in. I worked in Harlem when I was just 16 years old. But because I made an adult choice, I was treated as an adult. And I grew up very quickly into a reality that exists today, of course. But and still to grow, you know, it's a matter of realizing dreams and helping your dreams to come true and then to embrace new dreams. I mean, you grow, often people will grow out of marriages and they will marry again or not. And so I left the so-called marriage of a consecrated life into another type of life.
What was it that caused you to leave the convent?
You know, I'll tell you right now, it was like growing out of the life, like growing out of a relationship. It wasn't growing out of a relationship, so-called, with God or faith, but it was just everything that I thought was so precious and great was no longer that thrilling, that exciting, that wonderful to keep in this state forever and ever. And so, and then I became more educated. And so what thrilled me before, as to repeat myself, no longer was that exciting, and it was time to leave. And it also took, I would say, a lot of courage, because I was going into an unknown world. Although I was well-educated, and I had a lot of experience in the workforce, so to speak. So it was another kind of daring and courage, and sometimes we need to, you know, get a grip and say, hey, I need to do this. I need to leave. Just like a lot of people in very bad, destructive marriages. Nunnery was not that. But we have to have courage to move forward, to realize a new dream, and do what it takes to achieve that.
Still, relationship. It was a marriage in and of it, in its own way. Because
you know what you did
and where you did it. But the, culture changes, people changes, views change, definitions of life change, and it's got to be very hard to keep up with what you were doing in the beginning when the complete world thinks completely different now.
Yes, that was that's kind of the way it is, and so it requires courage, a different type of courage, and a different type of determination to realize a new dream, and through life we always have new dreams. I'm a writer, and so to be creative, you have to say, hey, I could go in this direction, I could go in that direction, and have the courage to do it. And I think a lot of people whom I admire deeply in our world do that. They persevere and move forward, no matter how difficult it is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's the fear factor. It's that not knowing what's out there, and it's stepping outside of your experience. And I really believe, somebody said this once, and I've never forgotten it, life begins the moment you step outside your experience, because there's so much more out there, so we don't have to protect ourselves and stay within that slight realm that we know we're safe in.
Yes, absolutely. You said the most perfect thing I've heard in years, absolutely, to move forward.
Yeah. I got that. And then I wonder how many, sisters and fathers stay within the church because it's a safe place.
You know, that's true. A lot do. And they've been accustomed to their lifestyle. But then others are deeply committed. And Vatican II, a lot of people thought that to be a priest or a religious, a nun or a brother, was an elevated state of life. Pope St. John the 23rd said no, and his encyclical Pontium Terris, all people are equal. All people are equal. Just because you're a pope does not mean that you are better than someone who is, say, a janitor. And so that was a shake-up. And so thousands, literally thousands, Michael, of priests and nuns and brothers left because they thought their state was so much more elevated. But it is what it is, and we continue to have great men and women working in different religious aspects, not only in religious order in Catholicism, but in different religions, and like the Doctors Without Borders, I would say they're an incredibly dedicated group of people all over the world. So we have good people. And if you want to call that a religion, I would say it's a religion of compassion and service.
Yeah.
And so I'm so happy if I could be a little part of that, even today.
You know, when it really comes down to it, let me give you my take on religion. And I think, and especially in today's world, it is so critically important. I happen not to be Christian. I'm Jewish. But I was brought up. All the guys I ran around with, all the guys I was brought up, they were 90%, they were Catholic, okay? And they were Italian.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And this is how I was brought up. Now, let me give you religion today. One of the reasons I think that we're getting lost, and the Pope and everybody else should be very strong getting people back in, and there's a reason for it, because religion in and of itself gives you an identity. And one of the things that we have been deluded with today is an identity, especially in this country. And that's causing all of the divisions. You look at the enemy out there, and what are they doing? It's a religion. You know, they're getting more people in who believe. And as we dilute our religious beliefs, I think we dilute who we are as a country, as a nation, and as a people. I totally object to taking Christianity out of the schools and the manger and all that stuff for Christmas. I was brought up with that. We exchanged Christmas presents. We had Christmas trees. We sang Christmas carols. It was my American culture, and that's what's being taken away. And I really believe one of the biggest problems we have are the people that are pulling away from religion today.
Yes, and it's a matter of deep spirituality. The Jewish people saved me as a child. Thank God for that. And my mother had a terrible nervous breakdown, and she worked for a Jewish corporation who said, hey, we'll take care of you and the children until you can recover. So I have the deepest respect for all people who strive to be non-judgmental, you know what I mean, not crucifying.
Sure.
For their lifestyle, but trying to be good people. And I don't say I'm a real good person. I just strive to be a good person, as I did as a nun and as I do now. And if I can do that, I'm a happy camper.
Yeah. No, and I hear you loud and clear. Good person today is a different story than a good person was 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, in today's world, it's different. We live in a very violent world, and this is why I believe that the more we pull away from each other, the more we get away from those common base core religious beliefs, the more trouble we're going to get into.
I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You said it.
Yeah.
You said it.
Anyways, and to do that. Now, let me ask you this. The book in and of itself. Now, I pick it up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael, take away? What do I get that I did not have before I read this book? What's my takeaway?
And I'm going to tell you this. I used to say I had a whole lot of things to say. The book, as you read the book page by page, you, the individual, will get out of this book what they need to get out of it. I don't want to tell you what you need to get out of it. You just plain will. And,
sure.
And also with all my books, I trust. So that's the excitement as an author and a creator, is to say, this book is for you. This book will open up what you need to receive. That's exciting.
Yeah. And I really believe when it comes down to it, it's the symbology. I, as a man, can read the book and get the same thing a woman can get out of the book. It has nothing to do with gender. That's what I really believe, that as I'm listening to you talk, it's something for everyone.
Something for everyone, for guys, for women, all ages, as a matter of fact. It just transcends stereotypes, thank goodness. I could say that. And the same for all my books. It's for everybody, and it's exciting. If my books can help anybody move forward in despair, look up, no matter what, it's worth the effort. So that was exciting. And also about being on your show. You're an exciting interviewer, by the way.
Thank you. Hey, I appreciate that. I really do. Let me ask you this. Now, as with your experience of being a nun, how does that help you really when it comes down to it on an everyday level today?
You know what? I'll tell you quite frankly. I'm more compassionate. I know what suffering is. And it encourages me to be a better person day by day. It really does. And to look beyond the superficial. You know, when I see elders struggling, I say, hey, someday I could be just like them. And to be kind,
yeah.
To offer a kind smile. It has motivated me to be a better person. Absolutely.
You know, when you really come down to it, you know, not being in the convent, but I would, and this is what I'm hearing, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but you're still a nun at heart, which is a good thing.
You know what? You know what? I think you're right. Yeah. Maybe I'm just kind of, I wear a different cloth and a different ring.
Oh, sure. And maybe the world is a little different. Your actions are different. There's a little more, you know, social freedom out there for you. But it's in your heart. And I think that's probably what drew you to it in the first place, not realizing what you were walking into.
You got that right. I really didn't. I did not have a clue. I didn't have a clue. Not even close. And even when I left, you know, I assumed I would be embraced by a loving family, and that wasn't what happened. But, you know, you get spiritual soul strength, inner strength. And that's what's so exciting, to know that you have an anchor of strength through your goodness or your striving to be good. That's how I feel.
Did the dynamic of God change for you when you made the transition?
Absolutely.
Coming out of being a nun.
Yes, I believe that I became 100% less dogmatic, and just felt that the collective consciousness were all in this together, and I released all the dogma. Honest to God, I did.
Yeah.
All that restricted us, that made us less compassionate, and more judgmental. Let all that go. So I'm not a dogmatic person. And doctrines and all that, I said, hey, the heck with it. Most of it is all man-made. If we could do our best in life, that's what counts.
And that's so
meaningful. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of religion today, it's ritual, okay? Ritual meaning you do this, you go there, 2 days you do this. And I think that there's so many people who forget what the reality of what it is, what it's about. Where it's coming from your heart. The walking down the street, and if somebody falls down, you help them get up. Somebody's
Absolutely.
At the market, the supermarket, they're kind of old, and they have trouble with the shopping cart. You take the shopping cart. Once, years ago, I was sitting down having a cup of coffee with someone, and we were talking about God. And I said, do you want to know who God is? And she looked at me, she said, yes. And I picked up the fork. I said, this is God. I picked up the cup. I said, this is God. I said, the chair you're sitting on is God. I mean, but that's really what it's about. When it's about a whole collective everything, and it's a piece of everything, and it's part of the belief system that is innate. Now, whatever happens when we grow, you either have it or they take it away from you. But I don't think that you go out and find it. You just uncover it.
You uncover it, isn't that the veil is lifted? Totally lifted, and then you're able to see clearly, and that's what's so very exciting. We're all together as one, you know, like you're my brother, I'm your sister, and that's the way it is, and it's liberating, don't you think? It's liberating. Also, ritual, if ritual brings us closer to compassion and mercy, all go for it. But if it is restrictive and it makes us dogmatic and judgmental and crucifying our beloved neighbor, then release it. That's how I feel.
Yeah, because when you really come down to it, life is nothing more than a big mirror. If somebody doesn't like you, it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with what they feel about themselves, and they're doing nothing more than projecting. So if you got somebody who walks up and smacks you in the nose or treats you horribly, and you think, you know, this is not very spiritual or religious, yes, it is, because it's you coming at yourself, finding a way to prove yourself right about yourself. So it's
you know what, and taking things personal, that's a challenge, you know. Every day is a different challenge.
Yeah.
Hey, but when we don't have those challenges, if we're dead, I want to be alive and to feel it all and to remind myself, hey, we're more than this. We're more than this.
Oh, yeah. It's like you walk into the doctor's office and you make this movement like you're making a bicep muscle, and you say, doctor, it hurts when I do that. And the doctor looks at you and says, don't do that. It's simple. We are just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Where can we find you? Website we can find you at.
Okay. First of all, you can get all my books, and it has the websites on Amazon.com. Just look for Secrets of the Nun, My Own Story, or The Shaman and Mafia, or Exuberant Women Don't Age. And my name is like Elizabeth with an 8 tucked at the end, Upton.com. ELIZABETHAUPTON.com. You'll get everything, Facebook, Twitter, all the social media stuff.
Wonderful. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been exciting. Take care.
Great. And if you decide to go back to the convent after this, whatever, it's not my fault. I didn't do it.
Hey, you don't count on that. Hilarious. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Esteban Colosser. Esteban, I'm trying to say it. Pronounce your last name for me, and we're on target.
Colosevari.
Colosevari. Thank you. I got it. Colosevari is the author of The Failure of Eternity, A Scientist's View of the Works of Providence. He's a scientist, a professor working in the research field of computer simulations of chemical and biological systems. He holds multiple advanced degrees from the Budapest University of Technology and the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. He's been a researcher at various universities and pharmaceutical research labs in Europe and in the United States, including Columbia University and most recently a New York-based private research organization. He won the 2006 Hungarian Academy of Science Book Award in Chemistry for co-authoring Introduction to Computer-Aided Drug Design. Over 25 years in his career as a scientist, he's privately grappled with the chasm between science and theology, two disciplines he holds very dear. And his debut book, The Fabric of Eternity, he shares results from years of scientific inquiry and the works of divine providence, and concludes there is solid scientific evidence to suggest that rejecting God and his loving care is against human nature. Esteban, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Michael, and to your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Okay, let me do this one more time so I've got it down. Pronounce your first name for me so I have it and I have it right.
István.
István. I got it?
István, yes.
István.
Yes, very good.
I got it. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. I really believe when it comes down to it, when we are dealing with science, science is something that's provable. When you're dealing with religion, spirituality, and God, it goes beyond that linear thinking that we have, and it goes into concepts that we're really not able to grasp because they go way beyond our ability to cope with what we have, i.e., the universe. It's got to end someplace, but how can it end? There's got to be an end, but how can there be an end? And that's where I think the problem is, with being able to say God is provable or not provable.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, science itself is not necessarily provable all the time. I don't want to get to be too technical, but
sure,
there are branches of modern science that is absolutely not provable. So I see a very straightforward link between scientific thinking and, let's say, faith thinking. And to my mind, there is absolutely no incompatibility between the two.
Where was it for you that stopped you and you took a look at both and said, this I need to research, this I need to move and delve deeper into to come up with some kind of an answer?
Well, first and foremost, I have been a scientist, so that's my starting point.
Yes.
But I have always been interested in indeed questions. And my favorite thing as early as in my teenage years was reading books by famous scientists, not necessarily about their science, but mostly about their thoughts of the world and the universe in general. And that's where I understood that if you reach a certain level of science and you are a great scientist, that's when these questions, these deep questions come up. And I have always been very interested in these. And then to be more concrete about your question, it was about 12 years ago when I had a long drive from New York to Cleveland to go to a celebration of the 70th birthday of my former supervisor there at the university.
Mm-hmm.
I just was thinking about things in general and then came up with an idea that I thought might be interesting, and that's how it started. And again, the technical details are not interesting, but this is how it started. And then for about 5 years, I was just thinking of this base idea that I came up with, which had to do with with providence. I believe in providence very, very much, and I had this idea that if you believe in providence, you have to believe in God actually interacting with you or
yeah.
with the world in general on a continuous basis. And that is talking about a universe that is not a clockwork universe, that God created some time ago and then let it go by itself. So a providential universe is a very different. But at the same time, the idea was that it would sound really, forgive me the term, silly to
yeah.
Have to interact with the world by violating God's own physical laws that were implemented in the creation. So my thought was that, well, let's just take another look at science and see if there is a way that is scientifically sound yet allows God to interact with the world without violating the laws. And then this is what I came up with say, a theory in this
mm-hmm.
five-year period. And then it took me another 5 years to actually write the book. And if you look at the book, it's very short. It's really only 30 pages if you print it on a printer without the picture and things like that. But it took me 5 years to actually write it. And that's the basic message in the book, is that I strongly believe that God is capable of interacting with the world without having to violate any kind of natural law.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the big problem we have, and I think Carl Jung said it, you know, assumptions that have incontestable conclusions, they're not provable. We live our life through assumption, and it gets away from fact, and there's a lot of confusion there. So this is why we need science to bring us back into balance, homeostasis, to be able to take a look at something and say, yes, it is provable, and if you don't believe it, you know, here's the why of it.
Yes, well, I wouldn't, in my perspective, I wouldn't say it is provable, but I can honestly say as a scientist that the opposite is unprovable. So in other words, you cannot or nobody
yeah.
can scientifically prove that God cannot do
that it. It's not so.
And then,
okay, yeah, all right,
as
looking
soon
at it from the reverse,
as,
yes, absolutely.
Right. And then as soon as you know, from a scientific perspective, you deal with the question that is possible, that is a valid, legit scientific question.
Now, by the way, what did you find? What were some of those things that made you sit back and take a look and validate your thinking?
It is that I am an extremely rational person, maybe too much so, but for me it is very important to have a rationale for everything. But mm-hmm. at the same time, I don't share the ideas of people like Richard Dawkins and then some others who also claim to be extremely rational, but based on that, they totally throw away the possibility of something beyond their rational thinking. So I'm being at least as rational as Richard Dawkins, but I do believe that there is something beyond that. This is really a very stressful thinking and a stressful state of mind to be in, but this is the kind of stress in my thinking that you know makes me ticking basically, and this is what makes you thinking about these things and go about everything when it comes to science and faith. If it was easy, then you know everybody or anybody
sure.
would do it. But it is not easy. It's stressful. It's difficult sometimes. But I just believe that it is worth doing it. So that
yeah,
is my
you're talking about the essence of what creates you know human beings. You know what drives us, what doesn't drive us, what we're afraid of, what we're not afraid of. Because when you really come down to it, what you're dealing with is, the essence of who we are and why we
yes.
are.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
What did you find? What are one of the things that you found that, as a scientist, you had to sit back and was surprising to you?
I have to be a little bit technical, but I promise it
sure,
won't be too much. Where I found this is what is called quantum mechanics or quantum physics. The amazing thing that I discovered for myself there is that when people think of everyday things in the world, and then they think of science as it is taught in grade school and high school, that is the totally mechanistic and predictable world. That's what everybody is familiar with to some degree,
yes.
at least whether conscious or unconscious. But something that is predictable and testable and that's what comes as the claim from many people of science when they reject faith is that, well, we can test it and we can predict it in science. But then when you come to the level of studying quantum mechanics, then you realize that this is absolutely not so. Testability and predictability and things like that are very, very different there. And again, not going into the details, what really struck me and it really blew my mind was how similar scientific thinking in the quantum world is to human psychology. It is amazing how you can draw an analogy between, for example, how a psychologist or a psychiatrist is probing the mind of a person
mm-hmm.
to find out about the conscious and the unconscious, to how physicists try to probe the micro world of the quantum by experiments. These quantum physical experiments are extremely analogous to, like I said, how a psychiatrist deals with a person. And I find it amazing is that what is familiar to most of us, the mechanistic everyday world, is actually so much far from the human psyche and the human and human nature. Whereas when
let's tie that together for
sure.
a moment, because I think what we're really dealing with, if somebody got mad at someone, you'd think that's human nature, but it's not. It's science. It's a chemical reaction within the mind. And we are completely scientific within that mind and body when it comes to energy and different chemicals mm-hmm. based on the emotion that are let go, causing us to be who we are, do what we do, and react and respond. So when it really comes down to it, when you're dealing with psychology and science, there is no psychology. There is science, and then the psychology is an explanation of what occurs once those certain chemicals are released and the reactions are created within the individual. So it's all
that
science.
That is true. That is true. But at the same time, with psychology, it is paramount to psychology that I would formulate it like saying you ask a question and then you listen to the answer of the mind and then you draw some conclusions from that. But by your question, you can influence the answer. You can kind of lead up to what you want to listen to.
Yes.
If you are gazing the stars, you can gazing them, you know, as long as you want to. You would never be able to change anything on the stars.
Right.
But in these quantum experiments, that's exactly what you do. The way you do the experiment, you are going to influence the outcome in a way that is to some degree under your control, exactly like it is under to some degree the control of the psychiatrist as he or she deals with the patient. That's the kind of analogy I refer to.
Yeah, and also, too, when you really come down to it, you get two people laying on the beach looking up at the stars. One of those people get frightened because they can't understand, you know, the unlimitedness of that. The other person sits down or is laying there and looks up at the stars and thinks, you know, this is wonderful. Look at the expansion. It goes way beyond what I've learned, and I want to learn some more. At that same time, you're talking about two separate sets of chemicals that are being manufactured within those minds, one making it feel good and bonding, the other one, the adrenaline shooting, and then you're, you know, getting scared. So you've got the same thing when you're talking about the psychologist, the psychiatrist. If they know what they're doing, the words that they say, the questions they ask, the motivations that they can give possibility for, create the science of the mind, which allows a person to change their life completely. If that practitioner knows what they're doing and is sharp at what they do. And it's
absolutely
science.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's total science. I completely and absolutely believe that. I've learned that, you know, many years ago, that nothing is accidental. It's all intentional. And if mm-hmm. we tied their inner intention to the outer intention, you know, we're moving in the same direction, and there's where the problems don't happen. When you've got conflict from the inside and the outside, there's where your problems are.
That's right. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's science. You know, when it comes down to God is a belief, you know, it's a something that you know within yourself. And it gets proven in and out, you know, day after day from the many little things that people experience. And it's in that belief system which allows us to survive.
That's right. And like you said, God lives within us. And that is very important to realize that's the kind of attitude people should approach this subject. God lives within us and within the world. Yes,
or we are God. You know, and it's an expansion. It's a something. I really believe when it comes down to it. When I say you in the general sense of the word, you can't just specifically tie God to a certain thing, you know, whether it's a religion or something. It's got to be everything or nothing. It has to be involved in every phase and facet of how we live, why we live, what we do, what we eat. You're going to enjoy something or you're going to be miserable. I really believe when it comes down to it, it's all spirituality and God.
Yes, and I think that there is a distinction here is that some people believe that like we said, God lives within us and that's all. And then, in other words, the universe is God according to this thinking. But in my view and the view of many others, it's a little bit different, and I believe that God is is entirely permeating the world, and the entire world is within God, but I believe that God is also beyond this. And
yeah.
These are technical terms, but the first one is what is usually called pantheism, and then the second one is called panentheism. And it is just basically saying that God, that the world is within God, but God is more than just the world. So,
and what's causing all the problems and the trouble in the world is very simple. It is simple. The different definitions, the labels that we put on God. You know, you,
mm-hmm.
you define God as one thing, and somebody else defines it as another. Somebody else is upset, and now you got a war. So realistically,
that's
when it comes down to
that's
it, there's
a very
not
good
common,
point, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Not commonality of definition.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, now we are I could talk about this all night, by the way, but we are starting to run out of time now. So let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and the book?
Yes, sure. Well, the easiest way to get to the book is Amazon.com, and you can just look for the Fabric of Eternity. And then I have a website which is basically my name, so I don't know if you want me to spell it out. It's a long name.
Oh, please do. Yes.
Okay, so it's istvankolossvary .com.
Okay, and if anybody missed it, it's up on our website right now, so they can catch it here. And it'll be up there for a long time.
Thank you very much. And so
by the way,
website,
and thank you,
so
much for being here.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was really
wonderful.
Nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, and good night.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Michael Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is...
It is a wrap.
The music softly dies. But I hope for yours.